Well, the title of this session and for three mornings at 9:15 is The Church in the Next 200 Years. It's kind of an audacious undertaking. I've spent the last 44 years trying to set the church straight and without much success in all kinds of ways. Trying to reform congregations, educate ministers, reform the city in the name of the church, generally doing good. And until recently, there wasn't really much evidence that what I was about was what anybody else was about. And that's always very encouraging. It reaffirms you, it gives you a lot of strokes, and drives you to your knees. What I'd like to do is to come out of the lessons that we had Sunday night, and it's strange what you can find in the Bible. We generally tend to find what we want, and I find what I want in these passages a little bit different maybe from what Walt found, but be that as it may, in Exodus chapter 6, God is speaking to Moses. And he's saying, I am the Lord. I appeared unto Abraham and Isaac and so forth. And I have established my covenant with them. You know, I have established my covenant with them. To give them the land of Canaan. The land of their pilgrimage. Wherein they were strangers. And I have also heard the groanings. I have remembered my covenant. And say to them, he says to Moses, I will bring you from under the burdens of the Egyptians. Not Moses. I will bring you. I will rid you of their bondage. And I will redeem you with a stretched out arm. And I will take you to me for a people. And I will be to you a God. And you shall know that I am the Lord your God, which I bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. Very clear, isn't it? Who's going to bring them out from under their burdens? Not Moses, not an army, not all the munitions in the world, not all the technology in the world. God. That's a very clear statement, I think. And then if we go to the passage in Matthew, the Gospel, Matthew 16, 33 through 30. No, that's Romans. 13 through 20. It's this familiar passage, you remember. Who do men say that I am? And he goes on to say, some say this, some say that. Whom say ye that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, Thou art the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus answered and said unto him, Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood have not revealed it unto you, but my Father which is in heaven has revealed it unto you. Not all the knowledge in the world, not all the research in the world, not all the seeking in the world. The Father has revealed, has opened the eyes, has given the perception, has revealed the truth. Very clear, isn't it? The Father is the agent of salvation, of redemption, of deliverance from oppression. And then the passage from Romans 11, 33, 36. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counselor, or who hath first given to him, and it shall be recompense unto him? For of him, and through him, and to him are all things. Through him are all things. Same theme all the way through here. God is the agent of life, meaning, help, redemption from oppression, deliverance unto the promised land, which means all good things. You know, it's not just food, clothing, everything. Well, it's a little preposterous, isn't it? And ever since I really took a study of Deuteronomy with an Old Testament professor, I quit working 13 hours a day and 7 days a week. And I figured that God was going to do something. I didn't have to do it all. Now, if you ask my wife, she'd say, very ambiguously, I quit. But at least it became a reality to me that I was not the center of the universe, that the world was not hanging on my shoulders, that somehow if I could but make contact with God, the source of everything, that things would flow. Now, it's very difficult in our culture to believe that. Now, let me summarize, therefore, what I make of all of this in terms of what's happening to us in the American scene. My argument then, you get tired of hearing this, I'm going to repeat the argument several times, but you get it all today and then you won't have to come back. The argument is that the present direction of Western civilization is very questionable. If you take this this notion that God does it, we are doing it ourselves. We are making, shaping, trying to control. It's a different way of being. The second proposition is that no new direction is available. There's no obvious shape of faith today. You don't know what to do with yourself. I talk to people, they're caught in jobs and in situations. A guy working for General Electric in Burlington, Vermont, and he's making munitions, and he doesn't believe in war. He doesn't believe in all of this. He's got a family, kids, he's got a style of life, he's got all his bills to pay, he can't get out. What do you say a faithful response is to him? I don't know. 99.9% of the roles in our society I could not serve. I couldn't serve with abandon and complete confidence. I had to drop out of the divinity school about 15 years ago. I still got my salary. I didn't drop out of that. But I just couldn't give myself to what was happening. It's part of American culture. We now invite students to come to the divinity school in order to have the bodies to get our budget, and we get rid of them after the first year or so. You know, we say we're giving them an opportunity to get in our PhD program, but about 70% flunk out. And the process is, you know, how can you survive and make it into that PhD program? And we're using those bodies just as clear as day, and some of them know it. Then the third proposition is that the church, in keeping with its calling, has a responsibility for a new response in faith, an effort to find a new way of being for everybody. And so it can't simply exist as a kind of abstract function, baptizing or picking up the pieces or encouraging people to stay in there, in that munitions operation and like it, or, you know, and it's got a function that's, and the church's function, if you look at it down through the ages, has shifted from one thing to another. Well, I'm now engaged in the effort to do this very thing in the context of our congregation, and you will hear about it if you stay with me long enough, about the very concrete things we're trying to do in order to experiment with a new way of being. Let me now summarize in a little broader way so that you get the picture. Don't get lost in all the language that I use. What will happen to the church in the next 200 years is that we will move from a church to a sect. That is to say, we'll move from a church which kind of accepts people and you're kind of born into it, to a sect where the meaning of being in the church is more one of decision. I'm trying to use Trelch's broad distinction between church and sect. In the church, you're kind of born into it and you're baptized into it and you don't make any decision particularly. it's just kind of a part of the culture, to a sect which has a very definite set of beliefs and a very definite way of being, require certain things ethically in order to belong and so forth. And if the culture is healthy, then the church is clearly a very viable institution. If the culture is not healthy, and I don't think it is very healthy, but it's ambiguous, there's health in it, then the problem is to develop a way of being self-consciously which is really countercultural. So you might say that what we're going to move from, in terms of H. Richard Niebuhr's categories, is from a church in which the dominant theme is the Christ of culture, that Christ baptizes culture. Generally speaking, that's what's happening in our church. We baptize the present way of being. We encourage our kids to make it in the system. We give them the power and the courage to do it. We keep ourselves able to live with the present situation. And so it's a Christ of the culture. Since the culture is very questionable, ambiguous, problematic, then what we will move to is a Christ of a new culture. Niebuhr said a transformative Christ, the transformer of culture. And that may be the category. I call it Christ of a new culture. That is to say, the Spirit is what the church is concerned with. And the question is how that Spirit orders itself. And Spirit is not abstract. It's very concrete. And the culture gives you the content of Spirit. And the content of Spirit today is very questionable. Therefore, we have to find a new content for the Spirit. That's at least the way I look at it. So, let me repeat, stealing from a little from Nashville. While we must have been doing something right to last 200 years, we must have been doing something wrong to be in such a mess as we are. Now, most of my colleagues wouldn't think we're in as much of a mess as I do. It's a very personal interpretation. There's no way out of your personal interpretation of where we are. Any significant action depends upon your interpretation of where we are in some stream of history. I say that history is slowly disclosing to us that something is radically wrong. You take the energy situation, was saying that by 2900 we would just have used all the resources, copper and silver and gold and tungsten and all the rest, just all of it would be used up. And certainly then we would have to move in a different direction. There's no way to continue our present use of energy and other resources. There's no way to advocate. What do we use? 30% of the energy for 5% of the population. There's no way for us to advocate that all the world uses as much energy as we do. No way to say that what we are as human beings is what human beings ought to be. There's no way to universalize our way of being. And if we can't, then I say there's some real question about what do we represent for the rest of the world, you know? We could become a kind of fortified island, but I don't know. We're so dependent on the rest of the world. And I see that Chrysler just, made a deal with Peugeot, Citroën to take over its thing. You know, we're so intertwined with all the rest of the world. I don't know. Our cities are in shambles. Detroit, New York, Chicago, Smog Angeles, you know. It's unviable. We don't walk in the streets at night where I live, and many places people don't go to the ball game anymore. Park down there, they go have supper somewhere way out in the suburbs, and the bus takes them right to the door. They don't dare go down there to park. You don't go to the ball game. You don't go to opera. You don't go to anything. They don't dare go in the underground parking there in Grand Park and so forth because of the attack. I mean, what's happened to our life? You can say, well, it's just man's sin. You know, it's something general about men that leads to our condition. Or you can say there's something very particular about our culture that leads to our condition. And that's what I say. Now, I know that, you know, human beings are not ever going to be angels. So you've got to make a distinction. What is wrong that represents what is wrong generally or expected generally because of man's, humankind's condition, and what is wrong because of the particular culture? Very difficult distinction. Second, let's see, I'm saying we must have done something wrong to be in the mess. So first I've said there's no way to generalize, universalize our way. Our way of life in the cities are in shambles. The rest of the world is not going our way. And our attempt to defend or to foist our way on the rest of the world has led to one fiasco after another. Just very clear. We have not really been able to foist or to encourage or to help nurture our way of life anywhere else, have we? Think of a nation that has somehow been opened up by our way of life. I really been led to salvation or to health. So that's my first proposition. There's something radically wrong with our culture. And secondly, we do not know what it would mean to live in faith, such that what we embody would be relevant for humanity as a whole. Something that held up for us and for all people what it means to be human, or faithful, or Christian, or reasonable, or whole, or healthy. And I think the task of the church is to experiment and to strike out in new directions, hoping to unearth with no formula, listening to what is happening to us and trying to find some new way of a faithful response. And hopefully something will come to be that's more relevant. I don't think we're going to, you know, we're not going to jump in and get a great new plan. But, you know, all the plans we've had for our cities, all the money we've poured into our cities with almost no result. We've thought somehow we could legislate it, or we could organize this new way of life, that we could bring it into being by virtue of some human construction. And of course that's running somewhat counter to what I was reading from those passages in terms of the way things will happen. Tillich once phrased this issue in terms of the holiness of the is versus the holiness of the ought. Everything becomes a task and something you ought to do is over against listening, feeling, receiving, waiting. Maynard Johnson was saying that I'm so busy up here, I left where I was, president of a bank and choir director and director of some other kind of symphony or something. He said to come up here in order to kind of have time. And now he says, I'm so busy moving people in and out that I don't know. It's not going to be easy to find a new way. Now what I've said in what I will develop in some detail is that the new way will mean a movement from a focus on independence, which I think is the fundamental principle of the West, to a focus upon dependence and interdependence. From a focus on independence, independent from other structures, forces, realities, to a kind of doing our own thing, to use the therapeutic way of life, to a focus and to have it focused upon us, independent from other people, independent from the larger forces, independent from each other, to a focus upon dependence upon structures, givens, destinies, all in the context of interdependence. And I phrased this while I was thinking about this morning some way, a neat little thing. God acts. That's dependence upon his action in, through, for, and with community, the church, Israel, the people, and that's interdependence. God acts, that's a dependence on his action in, through, for, with the community, or the church, or Israel, or the people, and that's interdependence. That'd be the fundamental proposition that I'm asserting. I make a few disclaimers in terms of third world and women and other people who see this kind of approach as a kind of a way of keeping the oppression, taking the focus off of equality, and the reaction is inevitable that once you've made it, as people say, in my community too, about me, then you can afford to talk about not making it as being the way to be. So once in America you made it, then you can talk about the idolatry of your way of life. Once as a white male, no, a WASP, you can talk about the idolatry of making it. So I'm very sensitive and aware that this can be seen as apologetic for the status quo or for privilege. Well, let me begin the more systematic, erudite, learned way of doing all this.
Excuse me, before you leave that point, you're saying, you're interjecting that there is a, hopefully some way that before, that we can explore that, being, say, black and not, and unemployed and that sort of thing, before we get to the other side of the fence?
Well, that's a moot point. I spent about 7 years in freedom movement in Chicago getting justice, $35 million worth of contracts for black contractors, create a couple of black millionaires. There's a constant struggle between the principle of equality and a struggle and push for equality and a push for the substance of that about which we're equal. And boy, I don't know how you handle that, because the press in the black movement is for equality. And to get equality, you have to have special privilege, clearly in the light of history. And the same for women. You have to have special opportunities because of the history. And so the question is, whether you give up that push for the sake of the substance of equality. In other words, there's a sense in which the movements want to be equal in regard to whatever there is to be equal about. And I'm saying what there is to be equal about is very problematic. And I don't know how you handle that thing. See, if you push in one direction, you might not push in another. And so I'm not against those who feel they need to push for equality. And, you know, I spent a lot of my substance in the last 15 years pushing for equality. But now I think it's a kind of empty equality. If I create a couple of black millionaires, and I called one up a little while ago, and he said, well, I'm working 18 hours a day, I got a new building, swimming pool on the top, and all this kind of stuff, and that's what I, you know, that's what I helped create. I mean, it's very, very clay feetish. So, I don't know what that means. I don't know whether I replied to you, taking you seriously, your question. It's not an easy thing. But see, the principle of justice that we work on is the principle of equality. Free to do your own thing, freedom and equality are the substance. Great Reinhold Niebuhr said that. The question is, what's the substance of the freedom and the equality? And that's the key issue for me. And it has been for 30 years, really. I took kind of time out in the freedom movement because I thought the kind of nation was falling apart over that issue.
Is there any place in the scripture where it seems to indicate that we have to be equal in things? So that seems to be the bottom line so often. I don't find in the scripture that God was against the rich man.
I just find in the scripture that he was for equalizing. When you forgave all your debts after 50 years, the year of the Jubilee, it seems to me that's a very equalizing process. If you just start over again every 50 years.
Well, was that a principle of the Old Testament that is supposed to be perpetuated?
Who knows? I mean, how do we know what is supposed to be perpetuated? All we can do is read the scripture and try to respond to it in the light of our experiences and our perceptions of where we are. And that's why I try to come out of the, I've got some other passages for the rest of the week, for the other sessions, I try to come out of some passages which indicate
I'm
a
cutting this afternoon. Put together a quick summary.
Yeah.
I thought freedom and equality were mutually exclusive. How can you make everybody equal without taking away?
Well, I usually say equal freedom. You put the two together, but you get the same result. That is, you want an equal, the only principle on which they can plan for the city of Chicago is to give people an equal opportunity to initiate, which means freedom to initiate activity. So it's equal. I think the two probably go together. Freedom does not necessarily mean equality. If you let everybody be free, it's clear that some strong people and some aggressive people and some people who don't have any scruples will amass all kinds of things, power and church everywhere. Doesn't matter where it is, they will do it. But so then you bring in the principle of equality. But it doesn't tell you what you are equal about. It doesn't tell you what the substance of life is. What is it meaningful to do with your freedom or with your equality? What do you want to be equal about? And that's why I said you want to be equal about the number of cars or the income or all this kind of thing. Or do you want to have an equal kind of being, which is quite different? We tend to equate equality in terms of goods and services.
That freedom would sort of entail being free of worrying about equality.
That's a different kind of freedom. I say to be a Christian is to be free from the idols, to attend to something significant with joy. With joy means you unite with something that's love, union with something, for the sake of it, because it's important, not for any other reason, not for your own status or anything. It's just important to be. Being is union with reality.
As we were traveling up this way along the coast somewhere, I forget what town, but on the board it said, free men are not equal and equal men are not free. That's just sort of what they're talking about and related to what they're talking about. That was written out on some placard or some board to some city.
Mm-hmm.
I see it.
Well, that's, of course, what Dostoevsky was talking about, my wife's favorite author, that you could be like ants. And you have equal amount of the things of the world, and you still wouldn't have much, you know, much reality in your life, much being.
Could we say that in Russia they have quite a bit of equality in things? China, wherever it's communistic in its form of government, that's more of an equality, but not much freedom. Is that what you were referring to?
That's the way I interpret this. This saying, the two different ways.
But
free men are not equal, because if you're free, you can amass, like was mentioned, one man can become very strong, and another man will be sort of depressed or put down. But equal men are not free, like in Russia, because they're put all on equal, but they're governed by a powerful person.
Well, my problem with Russia is that they have the same idols we have.
Same
idols we have. What's important in Russia is to produce a lot of things and to amass a lot of knowledge, particularly technical knowledge. I don't think it's wisdom. So they bought into the same system that we have, the system which says we can control everything and we want to, and if we amass enough technical knowledge, we will save ourselves, and if we create enough things, people will be happy. And it ain't so, in my judgment. So that while there is more freedom, there are fewer people starving, and that's a certain plus. I mean, you got to balance all these things. That's a certain plus. If you're starving, you think it's quite a plus. And I think people like me who are trying to live now on pensions and so forth, we'll feel it's a great plus. I just have an article here in the paper about the kind of salaries that the new elite are getting. It was in Time, this last Time, and you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year. And so with inflation and everything, you know, it's those people who are going to be able to survive. And I don't know whether some of the rest of us. So equality becomes very important. And if you follow my energy program, which works against the poor, unless you do a lot of things. You've got to think of equality. It's a very important regulating concept, but it doesn't constitute the good life. Neither freedom as self-initiation nor equality give you any notion of what's worth being equal about or what's worth choosing in your freedom. And that's what interests me.
You know, back in the Depression, we all had less, and we tolerated it. I was a kid growing up, so I didn't know any different, but as I look back, we tolerated it because it had to be. I think that I just came back from Egypt and the Holy Land, and in Egypt, the lady who was our guide said, nobody starves there, but both the husband and the wife have to work, and the children, as soon as they have to work to eat out in existence. But it's a very low level of existence.
Yeah. Well, I don't
talk about how wonderful you have it in America.
I don't think anybody can tolerate starvation. I don't know what we do about that around the world. You can't tolerate it. I don't think you can rest easy if people are starving and we are throwing food away the way we do even up here and are eating high on the protein chain. And I don't know what to do with the distribution problem and so forth, but you can't just rest easy with your way of life. On the other hand, you know it's complex, and you can't go to bed feeling guilty all the time, or you'd cut all the creative threads of your life. But you got to be kind of free from things, so you could begin to tend to some of those things. Now, I don't know whether we want to go on with this or whether you want to get a highly sophisticated analysis of this.
I had an interesting experience. I met probably the world's greatest playboy last week. And he has a home in Vancouver, a condominium in Maui, a townhouse in London, keeps his graceful horses on the Riviera. He's got a beautiful 25-year-old wife. He's 45 years of age. He said, this life is killing me.
Yeah. So? So what do you conclude?
Even it up.
Well, I'll take the condominium.
No, even it up.
I thought everybody had the same thing. Isn't that what they
even it up. Now, if I, you know, that, have I been saying we should even it up?
And he isn't an American.
No, there's a sense in which I've been saying the whole principle of evening it up is the most destructive principle that I know.
I know it is.
So evening it up is not going to solve the problem. If you just have a little bit more, so you can do a little bit more of that, I'm not sure that's going to provide, I don't think money beyond a certain amount or knowledge beyond certain amounts. People say, of course, as I said before, you've got a lot of it, you can say it isn't too important. You've got all the degrees, all these things that give you the status, so you can say that they are very, very, very problematic. But I think they are. We got to develop a way of life. Who was it was saying? Erling Jorstad, probably, because he's got all these figures always, said that by 1990 there'd be 60,000 unemployed PhDs. You know, why education? Why teach under those circumstances? What meaning does it do to be an undergraduate teacher or a graduate teacher and encouraging all these kids to go through so they get this great, great, great something? Erling himself said he wouldn't go through what he went through if he were doing it today to get his PhD. He wouldn't go through the battle. So I equal it up. Get everybody a PhD. Yeah.
Have less education that don't know.
Well, yeah, 80% of the jobs I'm told require sixth grade education. What meaning is there in work if you don't doesn't require any more knowledge or skill than what you can have in sixth grade? What meaning is there in work? Most of the work is meaningless in and of itself. And if you ask the end of the work, if you ask, you know, what is done with the products that are produced, then you've got all kinds of questions. Now, there are no easy answers, but I think the church has got to kind of find a way and just inch its way along person by person almost, and try to find meaningful work. And it's very difficult, very difficult. Now, it's not impossible, and you can live on the edge of an institution. I think I lived on the edge of the Divinity School and survived. My colleague couldn't survive. One of my best friend couldn't survive. He had to leave. He couldn't survive in that kind of... It was so antithetical to his whole being. I'm not talking about the institutions which major in meaning, whose focus is meaning, and not those whose focus, obviously, is not on meaning, or whose function is not to deal with meaning. Well, I think, you see, I think there's just the culmination. I think there's a culmination, to get back to my theme, of the development of the West. If you take the great sociologist Talcott Parsons' principles, which are the principles which the West embodies, which have created many things for us, to be sure, principles of differentiation, that is, breaking things down into parts and then concentrating on the parts. We do that in knowledge. You've got your departments at a university, and within the departments you've got little fields. They don't speak to each other. They don't relate to each other. They're related administratively, but not meaning-wise. What has happened in our whole culture? Let me give you the last 2,000 years now. What's what I'm talking about? What has happened in our culture?
You know what?
Is that our institutions have been fragmented and become autonomous. That is to say, there's no self-conscious, intended relationship between the economic world, the political world, the educational world, and the religious world. Economics is supposed to function autonomously. It's wrong to suggest that the economy ought to be subject to any criteria other than profit. Oh, a certain amount of integrity in terms of contract and so forth. We have a legal system which provides a kind of framework. But in terms of values, profit is the only criteria that we say should be applied. Political world, what's the criterion? Well, the theoretical criterion in the political world is that a legislator ought to follow the will of the constituent, whatever that will is. It doesn't matter what his will is. It doesn't have to be good. He can be unhealthy. It can be selfish. He ought to follow. He ought to so act that he can keep in power, which means he fulfills the desires of the constituents. You're not supposed to be a statesman with some vision of what the good is, as Plato or Aristotle would have said. The polis is the place where the common good is conceived and where it is implemented. Education. Take education. What is education supposed to be? Neutral. Neutral. It's not supposed to represent a way of being. It's not supposed to represent some vision of the good. And if it is neutral, what does it become? It becomes technical, or at best, humanistic. And what is a humanistic? What's the focus in the humanistic? Not on what it might be, is the creative values which have been a part of the culture as a whole, but on a critical and comparative approach to the humanistic studies, which means you take one, compare it with another, raise a few questions, a lot of it very formal in terms of technical apparatus which are used in the attempt to carry out some view of good and so forth. But does the humanist feel responsible for his own position with regard to what is meaningful, what is human, and attempt in some way to introduce students into a way of being? For me, education is induction into a meaningful way of being. That's what it is. Now, if education is technical or humanistic, the way I've described it, the only thing that can result from education is to become a cog in the machine. You don't become a person who is really asking questions or attempting to formulate a new way of being. But what happens is that education becomes, and you can just see it in the Divinity School, I speak right out of my experience in the Divinity School, what we do is ask what is being taught in the colleges. The colleges ask what will students take. So you ask what students will take, And the colleges teach that, so the Divinity School teaches and organizes PhD around what is being taught in the colleges. Not about what is meaningful, not the search for meaning, but about what is being taught. You become interested in placing your students and in teaching what can be sold. And I'm taking, again, the place where you expect the most meaning. Now, if that happens in the Divinity School, what do you think happens in most colleges? So your education doesn't have as its focus the meaning of being. So now I have the polity, the economic system, the educational system, and the church. Now the church, in theory, is interested in a way of life, a response to God, which is faithful. Faithful everywhere. Faithful in the whole society. But the problems are so difficult in trying to be faithful that the church has abandoned, for the most part, and retreated from its effort to deal with the whole, and you could just see it in the budgets. It's retreated into a privatized kind of relation to God, where the world is very secondary, and where the focus is on interpersonal relations. Not that those aren't important. We have a lot of house churches, so-called house churches, in which there's a lot of interpersonal relations, and it really gives us a great base for being in our church. It's just fantastic. But if that's the limit of it, then people go off into their professions and there's no help, no kind of guidance, no reception of that world and holding it up and looking at it. And so the church abandons its responsibility for the world. That's what's happened in the West. All in the name of what we call secularization. That is the separation of the religious from the world, so that the world becomes secular. It becomes its own judge. Now, the same thing has happened in our personal lives. That is, that's a fragmentation of our institutional life. Everything becomes autonomous, and no institution in our culture represents an attempt to deal with the good. No institution represents an attempt to deal with what I'm trying to be concerned with. What's happened in our family lives, our personal lives, is that with the fragmentation, the differentiation of functions, and the fragmentation which goes along with it, we as individuals have become what I call specialized technical functions. That's what we are. We're fragmented, specialized technical functions. And we go where that function is being performed. And so, where is it being performed? Well, we had two people in our forming community in Chicago, and one was a biochemist, and he couldn't get any more research money, so he went off to teach at Smith in Vermont. Another guy who was a minister, and he couldn't get any relationship. He couldn't find a way of being, of earning a living, actually. Earning a living becomes crucial. And so he went off to California. And I always say, you take my kids, what happened to my blood family? One is in reaction, so he bought a square mile down in Costa Rica. He wants to get out of this way of being. And my daughter is up north of the Arctic in Copper Mine. Now she's a little south at Fort Simpson in the Northwest Territory. Daughter in Tucson and a son in Washington, D.C. Now what is a blood family? No. How does that blood how do I know my grandchildren? How do I become anything but a kind of, I become what you call is, what do you call it? Deus absconditus. Well, I'm a grandfather absconditus. That's what I am. No other way. But what about this system? You know, the system fragments us, and it gets us performing these technical functions. One of the reasons I really had some problems coming up here is because I'm going to relate to you a little bit, and it might be stimulating, might give somebody an idea, but how can I continue those relationships meaningfully? How does it become an interdependent kind of world is over against this independent being of function, and you hit here and other years I've tried to learn everybody's name on the staff and all the people that I could, or guests and so forth, and I almost this year just kind of said, how can I do it? I'm just a little bit of an abstract function for all of you. I don't want to be that. I want to know you. I want to feel your being. I want to let it grow, and I want to continue. And first year, the second year, we started writing a big, long letter 5 or 6 times a year to all the people we'd met. So somehow, when we met again, there'd be something left, you know, and we wouldn't just start all over again. Well, I'm only trying to describe what I see happening to us. Maybe only my perception and only my own personal needs. But personally, I need a community where there's some stability, where if I care for you today, it's not that I need the future, but that there is some sense in which that care today will be building some relations which I can depend upon and which you can depend upon, where we can grow and we can begin to know each other, and if it's got enough variety in it, it'll be stimulating, and it'll be like this place is when you only have about 150 people here, and you stay a month together. If this place were here and you stayed a month together, you know, all kinds of fantastic things would happen in terms of people's relations, and it'd all be here. You wouldn't have to go off to get your drama at $15 a seat or 8 or 10 or whatever it is, because it would be done here. You know, you'd do it out of your own reality, and you wouldn't have to have all the things, and you would have the meaning. Well, now I'm getting into the solution, kind of. But at any rate, I guess that's enough for today, and now we'll open it up some more.
I just came back from the Holy Land and saw the kibbutz. Are you familiar with the Jewish kibbutz?
Enough so I can talk about it, and not enough so I know anything about it.
Jewish communal life. Would you say that that's maybe... what direction do you recommend?
Do I recommend? I'm you know, Niebuhr once said to a student who said, I got to go out there and preach. He said, I'm the wholesaler and you're the retailer. No, I'm against formulas. I'm only trying to get you to think creatively for yourself about... I'm going to tell you what we're doing in our church next time or sometime along here, but I'm trying to lay the background. You see, what's happening in our church is not simply, at least in my judgment, for myself, a response to my felt personal needs. It's a response to an interpretation of where the culture is, what's happened in the culture, what's happening to it. So that the community development in our church, for me, is a response to my cultural interpretation. And I'm trying to give you that broad cultural interpretation. And then the question is, how do you respond? And that is not something which I can give you. In a sense, one prays about it, one listens, the only thing I can say is one's got to withdraw a little and live on the edge of institutions and realize the deep ambiguity of what he or she is doing in order to be open enough to do it or even think about it. I mean, most of us are so busy in our occupations we don't have any time to think about it. And sometimes I say, thanks be to God that we are, because it's so difficult to do anything. You know, it's like the centipede. It said it was happy, quiet, until the toad said, pray. When you begin to run, which leg comes after which? That wrought his mind to such a, what? He lay distracted in the ditch. It wrought his mind to such a pitch, he lay distracted in the ditch. So that sometimes if you don't have a lot of resources, you ask these questions and you may go into deep despair. You begin to ask the question, the meaning of your existence, seriously, and you face that every day, then you lose the drive to carry on with that great sense of purpose that it takes to fulfill many of the roles we're fulfilling. And I retired December 9th, 1977, and I haven't regretted one single lack of that role since. It's rare, 25 years, and I've just been, you know, reveling. I'm now in the church, and probably that's where I should have been all my life instead of in that highfalutin university. And, no, I'm having a ball. with some frustration, but comparatively, happiest time of my life. Of course, Paul, my son, you know, I got a new son, and that's happy time too. Most of the time, I've always been crying recently, and that's mostly with Sarah, so she's the one who gets frustration, but I have to pick up. Anyway, what do you do? What do you do? Well, I think the first thing you do is to try to take seriously these passages that I read from, and the message that I get out of that is that God is going to bring our salvation if we can but get connected. If we can get unconnected, really. I guess the only message I really got that's is we got to get unconnected from the present American ethos, the present American worship. What we worship, Equus, got to worship something. Same in Dostoevsky, got to worship something. What we worship are idols. Now, I don't care what language you use and how much you bring in the Bible and all that stuff. I think what we worship, all of us, me included, are idols. And it's the American culture is the big idol. And we spend our time and substance out there in it. And for the most part, I feel we have to kind of withdraw. Live on the edge, not take it so seriously, be willing to risk. And of course, again, who am I to say now that I'm retired, got a certain amount of income, security. With inflation, it's not much security. But Social Security is tied to inflation, so I just have to be very open that I've got a kind of freedom, same freedom I had at the university. I had a job, and I got my tenure. I did enough to get my tenure, then I quit, and then I was free. I got my income, you know. I could spend 30, 90 hours a week in the freedom movement, and I spent 25 in the university teaching very well, but I didn't fill a role. I just was not what they wanted. You got to get free. I don't know how you get free. Pastors are caught. They're supposed to produce a church. They're supposed to produce a budget. They're supposed to have a nice contribution to the synod, and their status in large part is directly proportional to their contribution to the synod and the number of souls they have and all the rest of it. And if you get a big parish, you're marrying and burying and calling on the sick and so on. I mean, what do? I spend 30 hours a week trying to nurture a little tiny community in our church, and man, it is tough, and it takes me that much, and I only attend to, you know, a little bit of the church. If I were a pastor, I don't know what I'd do. You know. I don't know how I do all that stuff. I don't have to preach. I don't have to do all those things. I'm just free to kind of let a little thing grow. I'm really a pastor, but I have a very specialized function. And I don't have much status, and I don't have much requirement, 15 hours a week for 9 months, you know, get $3,000 a year for it. But, so I'm free. Now, how do we get free? When you got family, kids, responsibilities, all this kind of stuff. I can't speak for you. You got to get free, I think, from the idols. One of the biggest idols is that we got to send our kids either to St. Olaf or Concordia, or where's the other place? I mean, you know, at $7,000 a year, and then have the money to send them to graduate school and all that. We got to do our own educating. I think we got to get free. If God is the wisdom, then what is all this stuff we're spending all our life trying to get through the university? I mean, the passage says somehow that if you make contact with God, you become wise. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't say there isn't a lot of importance in technical knowledge. When I get operated upon, I want somebody who knows something. When Sarah had her cesarean, I wanted somebody to know a little bit about and have some training and experience. You know, it's very ambiguous. I'm not trying to say you just eliminate all that, but it's so much more ambiguous. And once you tell your kids it's so ambiguous, how do you keep people moving and attending to anything? You know? And that problem I've never had, and I don't know, with all the ambiguity. Well, maybe we should call it quits. I've done too much talking.
Who is doing the engineering socially then for society of the future? Are we just going to mill along as we have been?
Well, I think we will create oases, which will be a silent revolution, and there's no way to engineer the kind of reality that I'm interested in. Absolutely no way to engineer it. It grows. It's like flowers or trees. It grows.
But if you God can... said it makes this person replenish it.
Yeah. Well, you know, at different times, different things are needed. If you go now, you get your coffee first.